Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. This is, I guess, week two of our quarantine series of Indeterminate Length. And I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. Thank you very much. Are you and your family well?
We are well, and you and yours?
Yep. Yes, we are. Thank you. We're you know, the lockdown seems a little bit more serious now. And people seem to be complying with it, which is good.
Yes, and we are joined this week by a special guest, Devin Greer, who has been on the podcast before. Is that right, Devin?
Yeah, I think I've been on here twice.
So we were previously on an episode, we were talking about video games, if I recall correctly, something of which you and I are both quite fond, and I think Frank is not part of the club. Right.
Well, I'm glad you're not tired of me yet.
Not in the least. We are very happy to have you here. And the reason why we're having you on this week is that I guess Monday is Tartan Day, and your research, which is a holiday to celebrate the connections between Scotland and the United States, and your research involves Scottish immigrants. But before we sort of delve into your research, Frank, do you want us to tell us a bit about Tartan Day, since you're the Tartan Day expert among us?
Well, I suppose, yes, among we three I am, but I wouldn't call myself a Tartan Day expert. Yes, Tartan Day is a holiday that began informally in the U.S. and Canada in the 1980s, mainly among people of Scottish descent to celebrate their links with Scotland. Interestingly, it was first recognized as an official holiday by the government of Nova Scotia, which is appropriate, I suppose, in 1987, if memory serves. And there was a longstanding campaign to get the United States government to recognize it as an official holiday. And the U.S. Senate passed a resolution to that effect, owing mainly to the efforts of former Senator Lott of Mississippi in 1998. And Tartan Day is, as you said, it's a celebration of the Scottish contributions or the contributions of Scottish immigrants around the world, but particularly in North America, especially in the United States and Canada. But it's also, well, it's kind of grown in the past over 20 years, I guess, during which time it's been celebrated. And it's spread to other places like Australia and South Africa as well, where there were significant numbers of Scottish migrants historically. Why is it held at this time of year? Well, it's held on or about April 6th every year because April 6th marks the anniversary of the adoption of the Declaration of Arbroath in 1320. In the U.S. context and in the resolution that the Senate adopted back in 1998, the Senate made an explicit connection between the Declaration of Arbroath and the American Declaration of Independence. So there's a kind of belief that the Declaration of Arbroath inspired the American Declaration of Independence. I will say, I say this twice a year on the podcast, I say this, David's heard me say it now many times, I say it around Tartan Day and I say it around the 4th of July in America. There is no connection between the Declaration of Arbroath and the American Declaration of Independence. Let me be perfectly clear about that. I will say it again. There is no connection between the Declaration of Arbroath and the American Declaration of Independence. Nonetheless,
that might be on your tombstone, Frank. You say that so often.
Pardon?
That might be on your tombstone.
It will be on my. That will be my epitaph. That's what I'm going with. Rather enthusiastic nationalists pursuing agendas that are actually sometimes contradictory to each other on both sides of the Atlantic often promulgate this myth, but it is not true. Having said that, there is much to celebrate and much to ponder historically in terms of the links between Scotland and America, which is why we've got Devin with us today, because that's the main focus of her dissertation, her PhD dissertation with us. So there's much to say about Scotland and America. We just shouldn't say that. We do every year.
And I guess you were supposed to be in New York now for the big Tartan Day parade that happens every year, but obviously you're not, because the parade's not happening
today. We're recording this on Saturday the 4th, and the Tartan Day parade was meant to be today. In fact, I've recorded a Tartan Day message which will go out on the university's various social media channels on Monday. You can see that if you like. You can see me in my tartan trues. And it's got some photos in there of last year's parade, but hopefully we'll be back next year. Tartan Day Parade is a lot of fun. It's actually it's good fun because the Scottish universities all kind of march and we're often together in the parade, which is quite nice. And it's fun to have a parade in New York. So that's the Tartan Day Parade is good fun, and I'm sorry to miss that this year. Tartan Day celebrates Scots, the contributions of Scots around the world, especially in North America. And that's the focus of Devin Greer's research. Devin's a PhD student with us here at the University of Edinburgh. And I'm going to take a step back now and allow David to interview Devin and to talk about her research. And then we'll wrap things up with last drops, as we always do. So over to you, David and Devin.
Oh, Devin, thank you so much for doing this today. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got interested in Scottish immigration to the United States?
Well, I came over here to do my master's research in 2015. And my main interest was just the American West. I had the fascination with that. And just living in Scotland while researching that just developed my interest more in trying to link Scotland with the American West, and that ended up turning into my PhD thesis, which was looking at Scottish migration to the California Gold Rush, which started in 1848, and then I look about, give or take, a decade past that. So yeah.
And so how did Scots hear about the California, you know, they find gold in 48, out the big gold rush is in 49. How did Scots find out about gold in California?
Well, Scotland's a great place to look at as far as transnational kind of communication networks. Scotland went absolutely nuts for the gold rush. First started making waves in the newspapers. And the interesting thing about that is only the daily, kind of the tabloid newspapers of today picked it up. The more serious newspapers like the Scotsman, Glasgow Herald, and the Times down in London really thought it was just Americans being typical Americans and just making stuff up. But after the more reputable newspapers back in New York, so the New York Times picked it up, the more reputable newspapers back in the UK, they couldn't really ignore it anymore. They're like, okay, there's something real about this. We've got to catch up with the tabloids because they're far ahead of us right now as far as recording the gold rush. So it was about in October when news of gold started circulating the UK. So October 1848, and then it wasn't until President Polk's verification of gold in California. So he gave a message to Congress in December of that year. And when that reached the UK 2 weeks later, the whole of the UK just went bananas. So by January, you had a ship leaving from Greenock, reportedly full of wealth seekers and shovels. You had another report saying that someone in Scotland had already made a fortune from selling shovels. He hadn't even left Scotland. He sent a boat full of shovels to California and already made a fortune off of those.
That sounds a better way to do it than going to California.
It does. It does, actually. And then what's really great is the Valentine's Day edition of the Scotsman in 1849. In that newspaper, in the advertisement section, you've got a advertisement for a ship leaving later in the month called the Jansen, straight to the California gold fields after a six-month voyage around the Horn. Pretty dreadful. You've got a notice of a upcoming lecture given by Professor Anstead of geology. He was going to talk to anyone who wanted to listen. I think it was in Newtown at the City Hall, just about what to do as far as mining for gold, what to look for, and what to look for if you want to find gold, certain rock structures. And then you had another, like a personal advertisement of a guy who was interested in finding some business partners to start his own merchant business in San Francisco. And he's like, security will be offered of the highest standards on the boat over there.
So how many Scots?
We went bananas.
Yeah, so how many Scots decided to make this very long voyage halfway around the world to go to California?
So it's quite difficult to judge because conveniently, I look at a lot of census records. So conveniently, the 1850 census record for San Francisco had been destroyed in one of the fires.
Oh, geez.
So we're not. So I've got the 1852 census records for California. They did a statewide census, and there were about 2,000 Scots statewide there in San Francisco and Sacramento only. I've only been able to count for those. But I think by the end of 1860, there were about 4,000 Scots in all of California statewide. So quite a lot.
And yes.
They were the sixth largest overseas nationality in California. So that's after the Irish, the Germans, the English, the French, and I'm missing one more. Who am I forgetting? The Australians.
Oh, okay.
So they're pretty big group over there.
And what parts of Scotland are people leaving from? What's their motive? You know, are these people coming from the cities or from the Highlands, or where in Scotland are people deciding that they really need to relocate to California?
So again, the records are quite difficult to trust and to access because the UK didn't really have any good way of any standard way of recording who was leaving Scotland or England at the time. And in the census in California, it was only the 1852 census that told us where they came from, and very, very little of them said what city they came from. It was just said Scotland.
Oh, okay.
But from knowing that, it took a lot of money to get to California. It was about more than a year's wages for a working class person to get to California. It was about £60. I think at the time it cost about $300 American, which in this day and age is about $10,000.
At least,
Yeah.
Well, so it's like people made like a dollar a day, so that's about, you know, for working class people. Yeah. So that's about right. Okay.
Yeah. So that tells me that most of the people going to California from Scotland were in the lowlands, where there was a higher population of people with wealth compared to the highlands. And there was a big, big migration into the lowlands as well during the mid-19th century in Scotland. So, yeah, most of these people were coming from Glasgow, Edinburgh. I've got some from Dundee, Aberdeen.
That's where all the people are. So, okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. I have some from tip top of the highlands at John O'Groat as well. So there are some highlanders there. Yeah.
That seems like a big gamble, spending all that money to go around the world to, you know, maybe or maybe not find gold. You mentioned all these other immigrant groups who are coming to California. Obviously, everybody who's, you know, wants to make their fortune overnight, I guess, is heading there. How was the Scottish experience for these immigrants different from those people who are coming from other parts of the world?
Right, that's a really good question, and the focus of my thesis. So the Scots were quite lucky as far as how they looked and what they practiced and what they preached. In terms of it was very, very similar to what the Americans, and when I say Americans, I mean Anglo-Americans, what the Americans also practiced. So they were very, very, very... it was very easy for them to merge into the Anglo-American society during the Gold Rush. And the Gold Rush, it was basically, a lot of people say, it was a place of a new society to grow because it started from nothing. And all these different groups from all over the world came together. And a lot of people like to say, well, California could be its own and be cosmopolitan. but it wasn't really. It was more of another cradle for all of these Anglo-American beliefs to flourish again. Because if you think about it, most of the migrants to the Gold Rush were Anglo-Americans. And with them, they brought nativism, which was very, very prevalent at the time, Anglo-Saxonism, anti-Catholicism. And Scots, they came from a similar realm of beliefs. Anglo-Saxonism was very, very prevalent in the UK at the time. Scotland was very, very involved with the British Empire, and as well, they were mainly Protestant. So as well as looking the same as Anglo-Americans, they thought the same.
So can you talk about, so there's a kind of, I guess, a global nativism in an interesting way, that the Scots are sort of sharing in this sort of like anti, or at least some of the Scots are sharing in the sort of this anti-Catholic, anti-Irish sentiment that you found many American nativists expressing in the mid-19th century. That's really interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And they just knew what the Americans were thinking. They knew that if they were to get into this Anglo-Saxon kind of brotherhood, they could it sounds really silly. They could rise above the other races that they looked down upon, and that really helped them blend into society. And I wouldn't say the Scots are often called invisible immigrants in the scholarship. I wouldn't say that they were invisible. They were just less threatening. And we can talk more about later why they're, I don't think they're invisible, because they tried to establish state interest societies. There was a lot of Scottishness still around during the Gold Rush, but there are so many similarities, it's hard to pick them out.
Okay. Are there individuals that, you know, really sort of stand out to you, that they're interesting sort of stories of immigrants? Which Scots sort of are most memorable to you from your research?
Right now, so I'm about to hand over my draft to you guys soon. So I just finished going through my trip chapter. So I'm thinking of the Scottish guy who took the overland trip. He had already settled on the east coast of America, but when the Gold Rush hit, instead of joining a company of wagons to go over the overland trail together, as what was typical, people joined together for protection. To go over the overland trail, he decided to throw all of his stuff into a wheelbarrow and did the whole overland trail that way.
With a wheelbarrow. Okay.
Yeah, just with a wheelbarrow, yeah.
Well, I think some of the early Mormon migrants into the Salt Lake City, I think they often actually used wheelbarrows.
I think that was years later, actually. So I don't think he actually started the trend, but if you really want to take a stretch, that's maybe a mark of Scottish resourcefulness, if you really want to be a bit Scottophilia.
Okay.
But I remember, yeah, so he strikes me as being quite interesting. As far as a very romanticized story of the Gold Rush to like rags to riches, as far as a Scotsman, so the thing, like I said before, it's very, very expensive to get there in the first place. So there's not very many Scots getting to California that are very, very poor and down on their luck. It's basically the other way around. They're getting there with resources and they're leaving with not much. So you have Robert Watt, and his brother had gone to California the year before in 1849. And he had found success himself, his brother. So he came back to Scotland and for a visit, and then his brother returned back to California with him. And meanwhile, I should have told you about Watt's background. So Watt was a farmer in Newton Grange, which is just outside Edinburgh. And he said to himself, he's like, my life was all right. We weren't the poorest, we weren't the richest, but we had something to look forward to. But I saw my brother go off, and that really inspired me to go off myself. And before he went, he asked his father, if he could have permission to go. And something that really struck me was his father, in return, said, "I can't understand this spirit that has gotten into you, young men, about wanting to just go and seek opportunity when there's still stuff around here. Like, what is that?" And I think that really speaks about the character, about migration in Scotland at the time. There was this new drive to find opportunity elsewhere.
Yeah, I guess there's a connection there with empire, thinking about all the Scots who went off in various parts of the British Empire to sort of make their fortunes and the ways in which sort of there are opportunities and things. And so that fits. Okay, that's really interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And also, Scotland at the time was just going crazy with industry. There were lots of people. The population had boomed as well. So in a sense, even though there were more options for people to pursue, there was less places to get that opportunity because of so many people. So that's why people were also pushed out to find other options for opportunity as well. And I think that was what his father was referring to.
Okay. Now, when these people got to California, did most of them go to the gold fields themselves? Or did they go into other sort of adjacent industries? What did they do when they got there?
So there was quite a span of what they did. So Robert Watt, for example, he went and purchased a mine, just some land, a plot of land with his brother. And he said that he had learned from night school how to be an engineer. And so he went from just mining with a shovel and pickaxe over the years, over the gold rush decades, and ended up being a supervisor at a mining facility. I think he went and opened three of them up and became one of the richest mining corporations in all of Grass Valley. So he's not essentially rags to riches story, maybe like a Joe Schmo to, I don't know.
middle class to upper class story. Okay.
Yeah. So he was very successful as a mining venture. Most of the people that went did go to the mines, did kind of okay enough to subsist because California was quite expensive to live there. And they either left when they made enough money to leave, a bit disgruntled. They either left, went back home, or pursued other opportunities elsewhere. For example, in Canada, when those gold rushes were going on, or tried Australia. Or they decided to just settle in California and find some other opportunities. I have one guy who came over, had really bad luck mining, and instead he decided to join the army to push out the Indian forces. And after that, he got a grant of land and just started farming outside of San Francisco Bay. That was the rest of his life. I have another guy who came to San Francisco, decided he was going to try to be a merchant, but the lure and temptation of gold was just too much that he went to the gold fields, tried his luck over there for about 5 years, and he was definitely an opposite rags to riches story. So he came over as a stately gentleman from Kirkcudbright in Scotland, expecting to be a merchant, and ended up basically penniless 10 years later going back home because his mining ventures have just completely failed. So there's just a whole span of experiences that they had, and it was very, very, very similar to what Anglo-American wealth seekers experienced in California.
Huh. Now, so you mentioned earlier about how they were able to sort of, if not become invisible, at least blend in with Anglo-American society with relative ease, at least compared to some other immigrant groups. When do Scots in California start to articulate or present sort of a Scottish identity? Because it doesn't seem like they're doing it when they first get off the boat.
So I found learned something really interesting about the Scottish associational life in California. Almost immediately in 1849, a small group made a call to establish a St. Andrew's Society. And the weird thing about this is that it almost completely disappeared about 3 years later. And there was no word of the St. Andrew's Society until the 60s. And this really struck me, one, because the St. Andrew's Society in the East Coast are really, really strong. The first one was established in 1657 in Boston, and just long running. So I was just very confused why, if there were so many migrants from Scotland going to California, why didn't this St. Andrew's Society subsist? So what I found is that most of the members of the society in San Francisco were actually transmigrants who had come from the East Coast, and most of them were people of the higher classes or the middle classes, such as merchants. And what I think happened is, in the East Coast in America at the time, the Scottish immigrant societies had evolved into this kind of Victorian way to show status by being able to support the lesser people of means. And go ahead, David.
Well, it's just because, I mean, it's really interesting that it, you know, it takes maybe a few years. You know, when they first get there, they're not particularly interested in articulating a sort of Scottishness, if that's a, you know, the right terminology, but that after they've been there for a while and they've sort of settled, once they're firmly settled, that they start to really sort of think about maybe what they've lost or what they've left behind or what their connections to, you know, when there's the less fresh their connections to Scotland are, the more they are interested in recreating those things in California.
Yeah. So what I found is the first effort to make that St. Andrew's Society was more of an effort to continue their connection with their status, with their middle class. It wasn't really necessarily at the forefront to preserve or continue their display of Scottishness. It was more of a way to show that they're still keeping up with their duty as a middle class citizen.
Huh. And what kinds of things are these Scottish societies doing?
So they're having very fancy dinners. I have a newspaper report from 1850 that said the biggest display of wealth in a dinner has been displayed the other night on St. Andrew's Day with this huge buffet, all these speeches, singing of national anthems. They were very extravagant, basically just showing and flashing their money. There wasn't any evidence of them being showing their benevolence and donating to the poor immigrants. I think this is why they fell out quite quickly. There's no evidence of them from 1854 until 1860, really.
Okay.
So that told me that the St. Andrew's Society in San Francisco, at least, was an idea of more of the transmigrants and the middle class. And it wasn't until later in California, when Scots were less concerned about hiding their more foreign characteristics because they wanted to pursue wealth in California, that they yearned for this Scottish connection and felt more comfortable being Scottish in the public when the Scottish societies came back and stayed in California.
And so what does being Scottish in public look like? Are they wearing kilts? What are they doing? Playing bagpipes?
So,
what does being Scottish in public in the 19th century look like?
So this is, there's still an ongoing debate about this, because how much of it is Scottish and how much of it is American.
Hmm.
And I, from what I've read, I think that a lot of it is very, very Scottish. And when I say Scottish, I mean kilts, bagpipes, the idea of the Highlands, Robert Burns, Walter Scott. A lot of this had actually developed in Scotland during the 19th century, during the Victorian times. And a lot of this was a product of Sir Walter Scott, who romanticized the Highlands and gave Scotland the image, the whole image of the Highlands as the image of Scotland. The clans, he brought back the idea of the clans, the kilt. And Scotland was doing this because Scots were very pro-empire at the time, but they also yearned for a sense of nationalism that wasn't going to deter them from looking like anti-British. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. That in some ways, they're becoming, I don't want to say more Scottish, but they're becoming more sort of, they're embracing these kinds of romantic notions of what being Scottish is that they may not have held in Scotland itself. And it's only as immigrants do they really feel the need to articulate this in a powerful way.
Yeah.
You know, I'm kind of reminded of...
Go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking about these connections to but, you know, Tartan Day and sort of comparable holiday, sort of St. Patrick's Day, and the ways in which, you know, people of Scottish descent or Irish descent, the way they celebrate those as part of the diaspora is often very different from the way these things are commemorated in the country of origin.
Yeah, in America, luckily for Scots, the Americans loved this idea of Scottish romanticism. They loved Walter Scott. They loved Robbie Burns. Mid-19th century, there are about 100 statues of Robert Burns throughout the East Coast of America. They had Burns clubs where they celebrated Burns's poems and read them monthly, and Americans were included as well as Scots. They loved reading this romanticized literature. There was a very, very popular novel called Scottish Chiefs. Americans loved that idea of Scottishness. And compared to the Irish, Scots were quite a step ahead of being a liked immigrant group in America. The Caledonian Games, really, really popular right now. There's kind of a cool history about that as well. The conception of them was started in the 30s in New York. They were called sportive meetings, and then Boston took them on. Boston Caledonia Club took them on. The Highland Games started there in 1853, and then they took off in the 60s. And the really cool thing about these things is they involved more than Scots. So in these competitions, modeled off of like modern track and field, you were allowed to participate if you weren't Scottish. So African Americans could compete, Americans could compete, any nationality could compete. And the attendance at these games were sometimes up to 7,000. It was insane. So I've got one scholar calling them the first mass spectator sport in the United States, the Highland Caledonian Games. Yeah, and there's actually a funny thing. There were piper competition, Highland dancing competitions, along with the sports competitions. And apparently in the 60s, there was a shortage of pipers. And you have sources just saying this piper is just not very good. So they would just call any random Scottish migrant who happened to play the bagpipes, like a laborer, to be this image of the bagpiper of Scotland for these games. And in one instance, you had a hotel in Saratoga make a desperate plea to Scotland to send more pipers so their games could be could sound a bit better.
Yeah, the games are funny. The only places I've actually ever seen Highland games is in the United States. You know, which I think sort of speaks to their popularity, and they're almost having more popular among the diaspora communities, if that's the right term, and among people who are not even Scottish in terms of their ancestry, but are fascinated by the sort of lore and the sort of mythic Scotland that the sort of Highland Games evokes. So, yeah, it still remains a very popular pastime in certain parts of the United States.
Yeah, and definitely reading about the Victorian conception of what it means to be Scottish, it's still very, very prevalent in the American conception of what it means to be Scottish. And similarly in Scotland too. Like I don't think it's just an American fascination or an obsession that has made this idea of Scottishness very unique in an American way. I think it's also quite prevalent in Scotland as well.
All right. Well, let's bring Frank back for last drops. Frank, are you there?
I am. I really enjoyed listening to that. Thank you, both of you. I mean, okay. It was very difficult for me to keep my mouth shut.
But, which is remarkable that you were able to do that. That's a...
How many things did I say wrong, Frank?
No. We'll save that for your Bible. yes, my last drop. I want to plug our friend of the pod and friend of ours, Joanne Freeman, who will be known to many of you from Yale University and the Backstory radio show and podcast is launching a new initiative next week. And Joanne is launching a kind of online conversation called History Matters, and it's sponsored by the National Council for History Education. The first episode will be live at 10 a.m. East Coast time, so that's 3 o'clock in the U.K., next Thursday, April 9th. And I believe it's on YouTube. It wasn't entirely clear to me where it's going to appear. But Joanne is very active on Twitter and social media. So if you find Joanne or the National Council for History Education on Twitter or other social media outlets, you'll be able to get further details of this. But it's the crucial thing is that it's live. It's 10 a.m. Eastern, 3 o'clock UK time, next Thursday, April 9th. And Joanne is a very engaging public intellectual, really, and loves to talk about history, and very enthusiastic, and her enthusiasm shines through. So I want to recommend that as a something to do next week as we're all locked down.
Well, one of the things that strikes me is with all during this lockdown is, you know, that it creates venues for all kinds of public outreach things that people are doing from their apartments. At least from the trailer, it looks like Joanne's recording that from her office in her apartment. And I think there's lots of other people who are trying to think about how to sort of use this awful time for doing some good.
That's right.
That's great. Devin. Oh, okay. I guess I'll go next. Sure. Yeah. I want to also endorse a historian who's done remarkable works of reaching out to the public, both over the past several years, but over a sizable career, who has a new book out. It's Heather Cox Richardson's How the South Won the Civil War, which I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I just ordered it. But it's about sort of the 150 years after the Civil War, the ways in which, even after Confederate defeat, some of the sort of ideology of the Confederacy and ideology of the White South was really formative in shaping American political ideology and the structure of American politics going, you know, into the 20th century and into today. And I think many of the listeners I've previously endorsed, she's got a daily newsletter that she sends out that sort of comments on political developments of the day in a really astute, thoughtful way, trying to both, you know, analyze the contemporary events and analyzing the history behind it. But I'm really excited about this book. She's done a remarkable amount of public engagement in the past few years. It's really sort of awe-inspiring, both the care and depth of her work. So I'm really looking forward to How the South Won the Civil War. Devin, what would you like to endorse?
So in light of the terrible coronavirus taking over the news waves recently, I didn't want the sad passing of Bill Withers yesterday to slip down the cracks. Yesterday, he passed from heart complications at the age of 81. He's an incredible singer-songwriter. He is definitely the MVP on all my playlists, study playlists, hanging out playlists, morning playlists, like, terrible passing. If you have not seen the BBC live concert of him from 1973, of him in that high-necked orange t-shirt, acoustic, 30-minute concert, watch that. It is absolutely incredible. Great thing to just chill out to during this terrible, terrible quarantine time. Yeah, Bill Withers. R.I.P.
Well, we will all watch the concert in trying to find some ways to find some peace among all of this chaos and weirdness. Right. Well, thank you so much, Devin, for coming and talking with us today. It was really a lot of fun. I wish we could have done it in person, but obviously we couldn't because we're all sequestered in different parts of Edinburgh. But thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me on. You all stay healthy and safe.
We'll do our best. Until next time, guys. Cheers.
Cheers.
Bye.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.